My three guests this evening on The Core of the Matter are Louise Wallace Richman, Ian Wickett, and Tim Lavery. We're calling it Lessons Learned. We're discussing what we learned from the experience of the Smart Center exercise. And we could also ask questions, maybe if we have time, do we know how much the services to the site will cost the City of Salmon Arm? What about jobs? And what kind of jobs? And so really, what were the things that we learned? That's what it's called for both sides of the debate. Now, each one of you, I'm sure, has your own perspective on this question. And let's start with Louise. But I thought it would be a good idea, and just to let you know, to provide you with a short, 2 minutes or so, whatever you want, introducing your point of view and a little information about you, if you want, your initial thoughts and points. And that may take us past the first break. We'll see how it goes. Then we'll have a period of open discussion, and if time permits, excuse me, an opportunity for each of you to summarize, etc. So, Louise, welcome, and you have the show.
The show. Thank you, Steve. I'm Louise. I'm delighted to be here. I'm a mom. Start there. I'm also a grocery shopper. We'll add that. I've been in the community since 1999. And what always strikes me about this long and interesting, shall we say, process is that it started not much longer after I moved here. So,
You think you caused it?
No, yeah, it probably was. Most things are my fault, so we'll just go with that and move on from there, because it's not really about fault so much as opportunity. I'm a business owner. I have run for public office. I have worked for politicians. I like to think that I have a good sense of how the process works. But all I wanted to say to start was that these processes take a lot of time and a lot of money. And I think that by the time the general public got to be at those fateful public hearings, we were already 8 years into the process. So for me, the point of view I want to share is I think we might never know what the opportunity cost of the community engagement could have been if we'd been brought in a little bit
sooner. I think that may become a major point this evening. Very interesting. Anything else about the actual way it rolled out? Were you on either side of the debate, or did you feel that there were...
To me, again, I always worry that we're so determined to find a side. And the biggest opportunity of picking a side is that we miss the middle, the room in the middle for the conversation. I think that a lot of people came to the table in 2008 for the first public hearing. In fact, to go back a little bit, my first experience in this whole, what should we call public hearing experience, was in 2006, I think. I might be corrected on that, when the fate of this building went to public hearing. They were going to, the school district was going to lease the property to a grocery store, Loblaws, I think, for a Super Save food. It was a bulk grocery store.
Yes.
And so the first public hearing was at the Prestige. It wasn't nearly as well attended as the future ones would be, but I think that was the beginning of you could see from that meeting when council turned it down that there was an engagement process had started, and by the time 2008 came around, we were in full you know, I will picking a side mode.
Yeah.
Yes.
And people picked sides, and then it became polarized from there.
Yeah, very much so.
Yeah.
So, but again, for me, the lessons from that experience, which did start in 2000, that's how far back it went, was that, you know, there are huge opportunity costs following this process. And we know that that's how government works. You support or you oppose. I mean, even the... in Parliament, for heaven's sakes, there's a government and an opposition, and they're an official opposition, and that's officially their role, is to oppose. So we seem to be entrenched in these positions, but I think that again, I think for me the biggest lesson was there was a huge opportunity cost, and I'm really looking forward to hearing what Tim and Ian have to say.
Oh, I am too, and I guess one of the points you're trying to get at is that we don't seem to look for consensus.
No.
It's adversarial.
Right.
You're either on one side or the other.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, because that's how the system works. So we have an opportunity to try and find a different way.
Yes, thank you. Maybe you can pass the microphone. We have a restricted studio here. And my next guest is Tim Lavery. Tim, please go ahead.
Thanks, Steve, for the opportunity. And I'll cut to the chase. I think we have learned some lessons, but I think that perhaps not enough, and I think we've forgotten a few as well. Just taking off Louise's sense of consensus in the official opposition, it's actually the loyal opposition. It's recognized that there is a that debate, that differences are important. It's easy to make decisions about paving and potholes. It's when there's a conflict of interest that the politicos have to get down and not only make decisions, but I would argue engage in a transparent process where people feel that they are heard. And, of course, there's debate about whether people felt they were heard or not. I'm probably tonight just going to restrict my comments to, as I mentioned to you, Steve, earlier, the what, the so what, and the now what. Now, I do think the what was an old-school approach to development that ran into more progressive voices and viewpoints. I think the city, in terms of development planning, was old-style. It was non-transparent. They had a grand idea of a Western Gateway that was not widely publicized. It was going to be at a fait accompli. And the developer had an old style, and I think it's still their models of that, that you acquire an expensive land on the edge of town, and that's the basis for your economic model, that you have it rezoned. That's a part of the profit center of all this. And that you shift focus from a downtown core to the periphery. And I think most parties, while they thought they were up to speed, and I'd say most parties except for the developer, I would suggest, were surprised at the intricacies of what they didn't know, especially related to environmental regulations, Riparian Act, and probably a growing awareness that what's happened in the province is a deregulation of environmental assessment. And I think that, for me, of the what became one of the key components. And finally, I think the bottom line was, I think that shopping center, and I'm not expressing my opinion about the development itself, but would already have been built without much pushback if they had built it according to the way it currently is now. Instead, they decided to go for the whole enchilada. And it wasn't until citizens who had actually canoed on that area read that it wasn't a flood zone that opposition started. And so when I look back, that's the what of what I see. That was the start of opposition. There was varieties of opposition. Some people were certainly against one of the proposed tenants, an anti-Walmart selection, but others really looked at the environmental aspects of that, of developing on a floodplain. And so again, that's my summary of the what of the whole thing.
Very interesting point. I plan possibly on doing a program. I don't think it'll be next week. It'll probably be May 6th if I can. I have to switch something around. But there's been an ombudsman report just come out concerning the RAR, the Riparian Area Regulations. And basically, from my understanding, is the ombudsperson, I think it's a woman, has said that the government is guilty of deception. This is the ombudsman now, not me. That they have deceived us into believing that the system actually works, whereas really it doesn't really give us any protection for the environment. We have this appearance. At any rate, it gets kind of complex. I'd like to do a program on it to get at that very point you made about people trying to use the environmental protection that we're supposed to have, the legislation, and use it as it should be used. Thank you very much for that, Tim. We'll get into some of these points possibly this evening. And now I'd like to ask Ian Wickett for his perspective Before we get into just an open discussion, Ian.
Yes, thanks. excuse me. My thoughts overlap somewhat with Louise's, and but I bring sort of a different perspective to it. I think this particular proposal brought home to me that the whole process for development approvals is not really an effective way to get any meaningful or timely input from the community. And this goes back a long time. I can remember discussing it with Dorothy Argent in the early 90s when we were having very large and prolonged public hearings. By the time the public hearing stage is reached, you know, the plans and the reactions are pretty entrenched. They're very concrete, and there's little opportunity for a meaningful dialogue and little opportunity to shape the proposals to meet the concerns of the public at that point. The public hearing is kind of a stage for set speeches, ad hominem arguments, and emotional appeals. You know, the developer's firmly entrenched in his plans. He's invested a lot of money in land acquisition and design work. Council have been with the process in detail for a long time, working through the planning committee and readings at council. In this particular case, they were even more entrenched as they had led the way toward this proposal by initiating removal of the land from the ALR. At the public hearing, there's little debate on the issues. This is, I think, a really serious concern that even if there are two sides in opposition to each other, you can still recognize the opponent's arguments and deal with them, arguing, you know, dealing with the argument rather than only presenting your side. You have to focus and clash with the opponent's arguments. Sounds like debating grade 10, I think. In this case, on the pro side, the arguments focused on the consumer needs and the corporate needs, and on the con side, the antis, the significant environmental issues raised, they dominated, with the fate of the smaller businesses also taking a lesser position. And I thought almost lost in the discussion was the primary focus of a zoning hearing, which is land use and how it meets the community goals as expressed in the official community plan. So I guess my takeaway is that the proposal is pretty dysfunctional, and somehow an earlier process of obtaining community consensus might be a much more productive way to approach these things.
Thank you very much, Ian. I have a question that I'd like to throw in there, and then we maybe get the discussion going. When was the land for that taken out of the ALR? Because obviously that was, if it was an attempt by the city, I think it was quite a while ago, was it not, Ian?
I think Mr. Mays was still mayor when it was the application was made.
Yeah.
That's correct. So
2000,
that'd be before
2006?
Before 2000.
He left for Parliament Hill in 2000. He was elected in 2006. Oh. So, and they approached Smart Centers in 2000, so somewhere in between.
Yeah. So in other words, I think that's a little bit of evidence that Ian is quite on. In other words, the city, it appears, if they wanted to take it out of the ALR, they had some sort of plans for it. I don't know what they were. But that in itself is an interesting question. Would anybody want to make any comments about that? Taking it out of the ALR. I don't know what weight the environment plays in that. Is there any... anybody know anything on that? Taking it out of the ALR, that's land reserve. We're talking about land use, but does the environmental weight affect that decision?
My understanding of the process is that officially a developer, a landowner, will apply to the ALR to have it taken out. But as part of that process, the city agrees, gives their permission for it, their acquiescence for it, their support for it to be taken out of the ALR. And I think these developments actually operate hand in hand. There's a lot, and I don't think we have surmising. I don't think we have, I certainly don't have access to the what happened in the story, but I think it was hand in hand with the city staff, probably key politicos at the city level, and the owner at the time, prior to Smart Centers, to have that, to start the process of having that taken out.
So it goes back before 2006, which were maybe even 10 years ago. And so, let's carry on, though. We're still trying to find lessons, some lessons that we've learned. Let's go back to this that Ian also mentioned, the official community plan. So they had, was it not rezoned?
The land was rezoned, yes.
Okay.
But it, to my recollection, and it was in compliance with the official community plan, because it was within the highway commercial area, which ends at 30th. At the time that boundary was set, of course, that land that we're discussing was within the ALR, so it was not really foreseen it would be developed.
No, okay, and somehow, I guess a lot of these things are kind of, it's difficult, yeah, they're all interrelated, and they're difficult to put your finger on and say, okay, well, okay, but let's carry on. From your perspective, Tim, do you think that we can improve the process, and did we learn, just from what we've said so far, did we learn that we can, how can we get people engaged in the process if this public hearing is a bit flawed, let's say? How can we get them engaged?
I wish I had the complete answer to that. I actually think that, and I just want to take a step back. I don't want to dwell on the past, but I think that the context of the past is important of what happened. In my sense, this was a perfect storm that happened of inadequate procedures, inadequate policies, inadequate approach. And it ranges from a belief in planning that was not transparent. A lot of this stuff was kept fairly quiet. Limited civic local government abilities to actually digest some of this information and get ahead of the system and to be, at times, and I think it's a good argument to be made, that local citizen groups, and I'll say in particular water, were actually asking the tough questions that the city should have been asking, whether that be the politicals or the planning system. I think we found out the Riparian Act regulations, and we probably all got up to speed a little bit on that, were actually indeed not regulations at all when you really looked at it. That the ability of the Ministry of Environment, which are completely understaffed to actually monitor the reports that are put in, was a key part as well. It took a number of inadequate reports to finally get to the stage that we got to. And I think that the issue as well of it having to default to citizens and citizen groups and local professionals who work as hydrologists and engineers outside of this town, in the province and in Western Canada, having to step forward and ask the questions that needed to be asked and still are doing that, is an indication of just how inadequate that whole process was. Mm. How do we engage people more? I think it boils down to an issue of transparency. I would agree with Ian that, and I don't have the answer to how citizens get more engaged, and I think there's a responsibility for citizens to get more engaged. I think
earlier.
And, you know, when a hot issue goes away, so does the interest.
Yeah.
And that's what I get to. I think there were some lessons learned. I think we've forgotten some of them. I think the next development that happens down by the Smart Centers property is going to be very keenly and probably adequately handled. But we have other examples that are not necessarily riparian, where that process of transparency is not as adequate as I think that they should be. And perhaps, Ian, you're referring to the discussion of that as well.
Mm-hmm. Any comment there, Ian?
Well, first of all, yes, I, as I indicated, you know, I've been mulling over this issue for over 20 years without really arriving at a process that might work. You know, the ideas for development are formulated in a developer's mind, and he does his research and puts plans together, and he has competitive reasons for not sharing the information with the public. He has he's often working through it himself, not in a position to make any definitive statements to the public. So that's is just naturally a more private process. You know, the only thing that I have felt is an adequate forum for this kind of discussion is more in the official community plan process, where you can discuss these matters of land use and boundaries and without the pressure of a development. But then once that's done, then you have to follow the official community plan that you've adopted as proposals come up. And I think it makes it a lot easier for developers too, if you get the reputation for having a plan and being prepared to follow it, because then they know where they stand as well. They're not taking a flyer on a large chunk of land that they may or may not be able to get adequate zoning for.
Yeah, I hear you. The protection of land, or the land use, a number of things just came up. You talked about the OCP, and there's a lot of public input into the OCP. I know they really go to great lengths to get public input. And then, however, it is a general, it's a vision of what the public wants for their area, let's say, and in very specific areas. Do you think, and I know this is self-serving because this is CKVS, Voice of the Shuswap, do you think this radio station can play a role in providing, getting that engagement earlier on? If, let's say, we had somebody, we have a plant down in city council there. We've got somebody on the inside providing us with some information that we can get people interested in. So, Louise, look, you want to make a comment. Please, go ahead.
Well, I think what people have to remember is the business of the city, technically the city, the people who, the unit of the legal entity that collects money. This is a very formal structure. And then there's the informal city, which is the rest of us. And I think that council is really the touch point in between the formality of the city, and they need to be formal, and they need to be legal, and they need to be accountable. And then there's the city, you know, who we are as a community, what we care about, what matters to us, how we connect with one another. I think the city does an incredibly good job of the formal stuff. It, you know, despite, and there were some very big missteps on that particular piece of property, from the ALR to how they got it out to it floods, no, it doesn't flood. I mean, we may never know the whole story, but that's the thing about informal relationships is we all see the story with a different beginning and a different set of circumstances and different outcomes. And we've had a lot of time since then to talk about, well, I heard this and he heard that and she heard that. And so it is a bit of a mess. And we might never, ever sort what happened, what should have happened. But what I do know is that the one lesson for me is that despite what everybody said or what everybody did, ultimately we all want the same thing. A livable community. And affordability is important in terms of livability, but what could be more important than the environment, you know, and it's Earth Day today, so I just want to
thanks for reminding me.
Shout out there, right? So, and I think that's where the formality of the city failed the informality of the community. I don't blame people for not getting involved earlier, because honestly, those public hearings were packed. Standing room only. There was crying, there was cheering, there was booing, there was clapping, there was it was a completely engaging experience, except we didn't know that we were invited to the conversation till it was too late. So to that extent, I feel particularly as someone who spoke at those hearings, both sets, 2008 and 2010 or 11, I saw the blur now. The first one was probably the most exciting community process I've ever seen happen, and I feel like I was duped, because it didn't matter what we said.
Yeah, that's rather sad, isn't it?
It was sad, and for some people that was their first and only experience in building community, and they might never come back, because a lot of people were hurt by that whole process, confused, disappointed, upset. We had this moment, and as a city formally, we have yet to find a way to embrace the passion and the commitment of everyone who lives in this community, regardless of what it is they define as a livable thing. I really believe that there's no reason Salmon Arm can't be the most livable city in BC. No reason, except we don't seem to be able to reach out as a formal city and connect with people, whether it's little things. You read the notices in the paper for bylaw revisions. That's not English. It's not English. People get three things from the city. People in the newspaper who put those ads in the newspaper, those horrid full-page announcements.
Yeah.
That's not English. They get their tax notice. That's hardly plain language, and they'll get occasional parking ticket, which doesn't add to their flavor of, you know. So how do we do this? And there are a lot of groups working hard to improve that, but I really think that the city has to, and this is where I've been talking to council as much as I can, to say we need to find a better way to engage people in an innovative, friendly, meaningful, compassionate way, so that we can get this legal stuff done, but we can still be connected as human beings.
One of the places that we want to go is we want to talk about all those people that were engaged in that process, especially the public hearings, and how important that was. Like, how many were there?
Well, there were two sets of hearings. One was 5 days, went on for 40 hours, I think. Over 500 people spoke. The next one was 3 days in the heat of summer. Must have been 40 degrees. Fewer people spoke. It only lasted 3 days, but it was equally well attended. And as I say, I mean, for me and for many of the people there, that was their major contribution to local community public affairs.
But for some of them, it must have been a little difficult to stand up in front of all those people.
Yes.
And make a statement.
That's right.
I mean, and they must have shown a lot of heart and belief in what they were saying.
Right. So you could stand and say your name and address, and I think you had 3 minutes, and Marty was very diligent about not letting anybody go over their 3 minutes. You could also send an email or write a letter, and all of those letters were published and printed out and put in binders for everyone else to see. So we were basically, spent 10 days exposing ourselves to each other, and not realizing at the end that whether, as much as we want to think that what we said made the difference, the first vote was decline the OCP amendment, the second vote approved it. Both sides want to believe that they had some impact on that. I mean, to be perfectly honest, I don't think anybody who said anything had any impact, and that makes me terribly sad, because I'm not sure we'll get that. I don't think we'll ever get that enthusiasm back.
I hope we do. I think you do, too. And, Tim, I want to give you a chance to respond to that, because I think earlier you said something about people's engagement and what you felt was some ways of transparency, if you will. I think that's what you were getting at, or it was something along those lines. Go ahead, Tim.
I think that's what I was referring to, but I actually do not have a viable solution right off the bat. I think that the key is to leverage the engagement that happened over that whole process, the meetings. There's a lot of council meetings. And I think we also, at the time, this is where social media started having an impact as well. So there were Facebook pages, one sponsored by the, put out by the developers, Smart Centers, one an allied one to Smart Centers that was sponsored by it. There was the Against the Development Facebook page. Twitter was taking off. It was the 2008 meetings at the Prestige were actually the impetus for me to put out Aim High, Salmon Arm. I was absolutely blown away by the capital of thought that was in our community speaking for and against the proposal. So I think that there are a lot of things that were going on in terms of engagement. I think some of those still carry on today. I think that when I go into coffee shops, when I run into people, there is a level of political discussion that is still there in the community. We do not have, I mean, this was a pretty public family feud.
That's a good way of putting it.
And when that happens, emotions run high, things are said. We haven't, and I hope we don't actually get that, but I think that there may be issues down the line that will raise that. So it's a question of how do we leverage that input from all sides? I think it's directly related to the nature of the issue. And so I don't have a specific suggestion, although I agree in theory what I, again, think Ian's trying to say, is that rather than at general council meetings, and I attend them fairly regularly, I rarely see discussion on points.
Hmm.
I think that there's a more of a Socratic attempt to actually have a public discussion from our leaders, as opposed to, I'd like to hear your comments on it. I've never had the opportunity to sit at an in-camera session, but my sense is differences are worked out, may very well be worked out as best they can in an in-camera session, and then there is not that avenue for discussion that actually occurs in front of you.
It doesn't seem to be encouraged, does it?
I think it's safer not to, for a host of reasons. Ian's ready to go here. I'll just step back for a second.
Go ahead, Ian, please.
Well, on that particular point, I find it quite interesting that when, during the period when I was on council, we had meetings that went a long time. They started at 7 and they were supposed to end at 11, and we had to make a motion to carry on past, and it happened. It was interesting that there was substantive discussion on issues, and one of the reactions of the public was that we were divided, that that it wasn't a healthy environment. And so now I see councils over the past few years where there definitely isn't any division. You know, there may be a dissenting vote, but very rarely is that preceded by a significant debate on the issues. And they're not open to that charge of being a divided house. But somehow I feel that we've been doing that, and you know, we have in the public hearing, we have this acrimonious discussion of points that never clash, that go past each other, and then at the other side of it, at the council, we don't allow or encourage any public discussion, debate. So I think there's, between those two points of view, there's where we should be, which is an actual discussion, a clash on issues. And where, as I said earlier, that people recognize the other person's arguments and then demolish them or punch holes in them or accept them. But there's that definite definite engagement with each other. As far as processes going, since I'm talking, I mentioned earlier what I felt was some of the impediments to a more transparent process where it's a private developer preparing an issue. But there are certainly some public things that are policies that are developed or proposals, and perhaps one that's coming up is an underpass. But
yes.
But other issues of that nature, or even, heaven forbid, taxation issues, or public infrastructure issues, where the public could be involved significantly earlier in the conversation, and that the conversation at the council level could take place openly and publicly, so we understand what the various issues are that are being raised and the arguments and how they're being resolved and come together. And I for one would certainly find that a good start to the process of building community, that the matter of private land development doesn't lend itself to.
Go ahead, Tim.
Along those lines, and I'll use the underpass issue just before the plebiscite over the Christmas holidays. I was craving, so there was a unanimous vote by City Council to put it to plebiscite. I was actually craving hearing why City Councilors and the Mayor adopted that position. And it took, if I remember correctly, about 10 days to 2 weeks to actually start to get some responses. Now, to be fair to the politicos, once those questions were asked in a public way, they did respond.
Yeah.
But I view it as a, there's a thin line that they have to walk about being, there's some things they can't be transparent about. That it is in camera, it is in the city's interest not to have that information out, but it's the process of that. I would like to know from our mayor, from councillors, from the politicos, why are you voting that way before I vote in a plebiscite? And I think for me that's the transparent stuff. Ideally, I like to see that happen at city council in a discussion, but I'd also like to see it in a more public, I mean, Lord knows we're in a digital age now. You don't have to be an active blogger doing it all the time, but you can put out, hey, here's what I think. Here are my thoughts between what I'm doing, why my vote, what my position was on this matter. And I just, to wrap that up, I do think that there are, in terms of engagement, there are some leveraging that takes place today. I think we have a lot of positive lessons to be learned. I just don't think that there's enough of them.
Well, very good. Louise, I know you want to say something, but please hold that thought. We have about 10 minutes left, and I wonder if, because I think it was Tim, actually, and Ian that referred to the new issue coming up before us, the underpass, do you think that it's happening early enough where we're getting citizens engaged, or is there some problem there too? They didn't get the numbers for the plebiscite, but do you think it's the process is early enough? Louise, I see you shaking your head a little bit. Go ahead.
Well, again, that's another example that underpass has been on the books for 10, 15 years. It's just the formality of leasing the land from the private property owner made this situation happen. So I think it's another example of if the city or council did a better job of having a clear corporate or clear, you know, I'm a corporate communications professional, clear communication guidelines with the city processes, whether it be how they handle their social media, how they write those notices in the paper, you know, whether the mayor has a council of people of other community groups, that sort of thing. So there, I think there are ways that we could have avoided this. And I, as for my own position, is it too late? Is it too early? I'm quite frankly confused by the whole thing. I understand. I think we have to have the greater conversation about how do we envision our access to the lake.
Well, that was talked about a little bit earlier, and I want to get to that. You know, you talked about a livable city, Earth Day, and a livable city, and the OCP, I believe, is supposed to go directly to that. It's supposed to really, in great measure. Ian, do you have anything to say about the OCP and its description of a livable city, or how we the citizens want this city to develop? Or do you think it goes into enough detail?
I think it sketches in a broad way how somebody wants the community to look like. It was arrived at with a lot of public debate. There's hours spent over, three sentences. You know, when you're talking about broad goals, there's a lot of discussion goes into that at the planning and council level. I think it does a pretty good job of describing the type of community we would like to see. I have dozens of quibbles that I could deal with, but by and large, I think it does a pretty good job. And I really think that the area in which I personally feel it has fallen down in the past 10 years is not being followed.
Ah. Tim, go ahead. You want to make a comment?
Well, and just in conjunction with Ian, I think an OCP is an expression, a broad painting of public will. And I just don't want to see it changed at will.
Yeah, I think a lot of people would agree with you. We have so much goes into it. How can they change it so easily?
That's right, and the way it gets changed. And I agree with the definition. It's a living document. We don't want to be so rigid and inflexible. It's never ever changed until 8 years later when we do the next OCP. But I think it's too often changed just on the pressing economic proposal that's in front of City Council. And do I have 30 seconds just for a quick example?
Oh, go ahead. We have about 6 minutes left, please.
Down by Bastion School and the Holiday Inn, where the underpass now is, before that was developed, there was an application to put a car wash by the pedestrian underpass.
Mm-hmm.
It barely was rejected. And the discussion at the time and that's my neighborhood, to the community who was speaking against it was, you've got to get with the times, this is a living document, and again, it was defeated because it was a tie vote, is what actually happened.
Oh.
It went against the overall intent of the OCP of where we put automobile-related industry in town. It was an economic idea that was there that at the time that council, Mayor Mays, I call him Mays, was the mayor at the time, and the those in favor of it were arguing the economic option of that. I was shocked that it was defeated. It could very well have been there. And then we get locked into all the tumbling dominoes from that about, thank heavens it was defeated, because then the underpass was allowed to get in there and entry onto the highway was there. So I think the living document example of an OCP is too often manipulated, in my view, to suit the proposal that may be in front of council at the time.
It has to get condensed down, doesn't it? I mean, there's all that input that goes into creating the document. Louise, you have a comment. Please go ahead.
Well, I just am suddenly aware that there are people listening at home thinking, well, that's all fine and dandy, but what can I do?
Go ahead. Right. That was my next question.
Oh, okay.
Actually.
And I mean, so the example of the car wash near Bastion, you know, those people went to that council meeting. So that's the number one thing is you need to go to these meetings and you need to pay attention, even if it isn't necessarily in plain language. And the other thing is you've elected a council of six and a mayor of one, and you have their emails and their phone numbers. I mean, phone them, email them. Don't be afraid. Did they put their pants on one leg at a time like the rest of us? You know, that's their job. We tend to jump right to that. I'm going to write a letter to the editor. I'm going to do this. I'm going to cause a stink. And then you have that moment of righteous indignation. And for what? It doesn't do anything. So don't wait to be poked to the point of anger or frustration. You know, don't wait to be asked. Go and ask about the things that you need to
participate,
right? And and talk to your neighbors, especially talk to young neighbors. You know, where young people are going to have to deal with all these things that we do. We need to know what they think. And I guess it's just, and talk to people about voting. I mean, only, you know, 44% of us voted last time. And democracy only works if we do. So we can complain all we want, but we really have to, you know, own the responsibility of getting involved.
It's our city.
And it's not scary, and it's not intimidating. And you don't have to be a smarty pants. You just have to care, you know? And remember, it's not about being for or against so much as being involved. And if for me, if there's one takeaway from this whole thing, which I formerly referred to as a fiasco, is that people were so involved, and that's the opportunity that we have.
We have. Okay, what advice, just before, we got about a minute or two, what advice, very quickly, you got 20 seconds, what advice would you give to the council? You've talked about the people, the engagement, what advice would you give to our city council?
Well, maybe to let their guard down a bit, because I think they think that we're not allowed to ask them things, and they think they're not allowed to answer us. I mean, let's make that all clear, and that's part of a communication plan.
Ian, if you have anything to say, you got about 30 seconds or so. Go right ahead.
Okay, well, I just think that the idea that we have to recognize that people are more complex than being for or against us, and that there's elements of other people's arguments that you may not agree with the conclusion, but they're worthwhile elements. And somehow we have to recognize that we are a community, that we're in it together, and we're not two warring sides, and one of them is going to win and kick the other one out of the town, because it isn't going to happen.
No. Okay, Tim, you have 20 seconds to have the last word.
Thanks for the opportunity, Steve. I think that citizens can handle objective information. I think an opportunity to be a little more transparent and provide that will go a long way.
Thank you very much, Tim Lavery and Louise Wallace Richmond and Ian Wickett. You've been listening to a panel discussion on the lessons learned from the Smart Center exercise we had. I'm not sure that we solved any problems, but I think I heard some very interesting points made this evening. And I want to thank my guests for coming and taking the time out. You're listening to CKVS 93.7, Voice of the Shuswap, here in Salmon Arm.